I have to use my Bible this morning some because when I was writing my message, I forgot to write some of it on my slides list. So some of the verses I have to read out of the Bible, which I usually do at the same time when I'm writing it. But I didn't notice it until I went through it. And I'm thinking as I went through it, hey, I didn't have that verse on my list. So there's a couple of them that I'm just going to read that are not on slides. To start this morning, I have a collage of videos that you might find interesting. Let's just go ahead and watch them. Is that on here?
I can flip through them. They're all individual.
They're individual?
Yeah.
Oh, Timothy's gonna take us through. It has to do with our subject this morning. Oh my goodness. I don't know if any of you guys have pets or a dog, but that's why they have dog obedience schools and training to help your dog to obey commands and stuff like that. But if you look at those or watch those or watch very many of those, then you sometimes realize that the commanders need to go to the obedience school just as much as the dog does. I don't know which one's worse, the people or the dogs. So in case you didn't guess, today's message is about obedience. At the end of August, which was the 31st, we had our last communion service. It's a reminder to you guys that they always occur at 6:30 in the evening on the fifth Sunday of any month. Any month that has five Sundays, it's at 6:30 on that fifth Sunday. Our next one is November 13th, still a few months away. Baptized members are welcome to partake in that service. Just a little bit about that we do have it, but it's only four times a year. In that service, I usually have a short message before the emblems, and the last one was about the obedience of Christ. And you can maybe, as we go through some of these scenarios, think back about those different videos that we just saw and kind of parallel what was going on in the video with things that I described that are coming up in this message. But the last one was a little message about the obedience that Christ showed in his life and in his ministry. And that message that I gave then was what inspired me to use the same topic for this morning's message of obedience. And I want to bring out a few points that I think are useful from that service message before we get into the newer material today. Sorry, my nose is running. It's because I was laughing during the videos and it makes my nose run sometimes, as long as my feet don't smell. So, warning. This next statement is directly from AI. So, use caution as you understand it. Here's the question I asked AI. I always preface with, if I want a religious answer, I always preface my question with, KJV, which is King James Version, so that it knows it's going to be about the Bible, all right? So my question went like this. KJV, any verse about God being obedient? And then I pushed whatever this. It's not send. Whatever it is. Go. Yeah, go. And AI answer pops up. AI. What's the other words they put with it? AI. I can't remember the words they use. It's not interview, but
OpenAI.
I don't know. Summarizing AI summary or something like that. And here's the answer. No verse in the King James Bible state that God is obedient. I wasn't shocked. I was just wanting to know that if there was one there, I wanted to know what it was and what it said. But there is no verse in the Bible that says God is obedient. So If we look at the Bible, or the whole Bible, as an unchanging narrative, so what I'm suggesting is, and you can argue me with this if you want later, if I think this is an unchanging story that is from beginning to end, and little bits and pieces are scattered through the whole thing, but it's all the same story and it doesn't change. If we look at the Bible that way, we can see God as a major role in the whole story. You have to see that, right? God is, in the beginning, God created, so it kind of starts with God. We also see that Jesus as a major role in the story of the whole Bible, even though he doesn't start until like this far in. He's only from here after. Before that, he's only prophecy. But we see that those two are major roles in the whole Bible. I think you have to come away with that in order to make good sense of anything about the Bible, that the two are the two major roles in the Bible. And as we go through the Bible, we learn character traits of all the different recorded roles. And I'll give you an example. Abraham, what's he known for? I'm asking you to answer me. Faith. That's what I had, faith, or even a friend of God. He was also called a friend of God. How about Job? What do you think of? What's Job known for his character trait? Patience, I heard somebody say over there. I'm not going to stop until you answer. Peter, remember I said Peter would be in the message? Here's where he is. What's his character trait known for? I bet nobody says what I have written.
Presumptuous.
I put cocky. So maybe that's the same thing. How about Judas? What's he known for? A traitor, I heard. That's what I had written. Ananias and Sapphira.
Liars.
Did you say liars?
Liars.
He said liars. The third time he said liars. That's what they're known for, being liars. How about David? What's he known for? A character trait. He was brave. That's a good one. I had written a man after God's own heart. So we can see that the Bible teaches us that different characters have different character traits, or the different people that are written in the Bible. Don't forget that the Bible is written by 40 different authors about a lot of different people. So as we read through those different stories, we can pick up on different traits of character that the different people have. So in our world of religion, we need to notice that character traits are important. I think we need to notice that they're important. A character of a person is very important. So these traits that we learn about these different people are important traits. The Bible shows the difference between God's character and Jesus' character. So therefore, they cannot be the same having different traits of character. That's a point that I wanted to bring out for people that are defending that God is God and Jesus is Jesus. That's an important point of defense, that they have different characters. They don't have the same character, therefore they're not the same people or the same entity. So that's what we teach here, that Jesus really is God's Son. That's what we teach here. And I have a slide here that has, it's divided, a verse section divided into two. It's on two different slides, but this is kind of a preface about the character of God and what obedience is to him. Did I go the wrong way? Is it not on? Oh, it's never on when I get this. That's not it. Did you notice that that dog in the picture completely missed the mark? The guy had it right there. It wasn't even moving, and it just, like, missed it by a lot. just went, poof. That was just a point of, okay, so Job, I'm going to go through Job 9, 1 through 10. This is the first five verses. And this is some about God's character. Then Job answered. This is Job talking about God in some of the talk that goes on in Job, the book of Job. Job answered, "In truth, I know that this is so. How much can a man be right before God?" So he's comparing kind of man and God. "If one wishes to dispute with him, he could not answer him once in 1,000 times. Wise in heart and mighty in strength, who has defiled him without harm? It is God who removes the mountains. They know not how. It's he who overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble, who commands the sun not to shine and sets a seal upon the stars, who alone stretches out the heavens and tramples down the waves of the sea, who makes the bear, Orion, and Pleiades, and the chambers of the south, who does great things, unfathomable, and wondrous works without number." And that's Job speaking about God. And I read those words that he wrote, and I think to myself, self, this person that Job is talking about isn't obedient to anyone. Everything is obedient to him. So the difference between God and Jesus, the obedience of God, everything is obedient to him. Jesus was obedient to God, so that they can't be the same if they share different characteristics. It indicates that all things are obedient to God. He has no one to be obedient to. Another point from that communion message is in this slide, Philippians 2:8. "Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by..." This is about Jesus, not about God. "He, as appearance of a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross." And it's just a little short sentence, but it's got some major characteristic difference between what we just read about God and this, what we're reading about Jesus. And one of them is the word obedience is in there. God is not obedient to anything or anyone. He's God. Everything is obedient to him. But that's like a tail on a dog is wagged because the dog is happy. And then you hear the phrase, the tail is wagging the dog. The tail is really still, but the dog is moving. That's backwards. The dog is moving the tail. Obedience is the same way with God. God is what everything is obedient to. I don't know if you'll notice, but there are red letters in the middle. And my statement about that was, die is in the middle of obedience for Jesus. He died in place of us. And there are two things in here about, in that verse, the Philippians 2:8. There are two different things in there that point out different characteristics. But one thing Jennifer noticed in that I had this, that die is in the middle of obedience, but also it's kind of like a timeline too, because if you were to put a cross where die is, and in that obedience, then you would have people before the cross and you'd have people after the cross. And he died for all those that were before and those that were after. So even though he's in the middle, he still died for those that were before him. So that's just a nice little point about obedience, or about the word obedience. And there was another one in there, that Obed is, if you were going to look at root words, Obed is the very first part of that word, and David's father was named Obed, and David is the one who Christ takes the throne from, or after David, Christ is the next to take the throne of Israel that God promises. So that Obed is in there too. She thought that was interesting. I did too. But there are two things in there about God and Jesus and the differences of their characters. And in the one in Philippians 2:8, Jesus died. God does not die. God never dies, cannot die. And Jesus is obedient to the point of death. God is obedient to nothing. What about us? What about this world? How does God look at obedience now? What is it even to be obedient to God? And what does that even mean? Hopefully by God's word, some or maybe one of these questions may be answered today. Here are a couple of Bible verses that have kind of a weird King James-y sound, even though it's not King James, it's NASB. This is what I use, but they sound King James-y. Sometimes those weird words, though, make you remember what those verses are and help you to find a verse, and it did for me for this message. And the Hebrews 12, 1 and 2 has those verses. They sound King James-y, and I want to read it. It says, "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." So what is King Jamesy in that is, "so great a cloud of witnesses." Whoever says that, I don't ever hear that in a conversation. I never did at school. But it made me remember that verse, and so I brought it for you. Whoops. I thought there was a space between there, but there's not. So what is a great cloud of witnesses, and how does that help us? Well, the previous chapter, known as, that was Hebrews 12, 1. The previous chapter is Hebrews 11, if you can do your math and subtract 1. And it's also known as the faith chapter. I count at least in Hebrews 11, I count at least 35 people, some by name and some not by name. These people are mentioned in other books of the Bible. So Hebrews 11 is a list of people that are scattered throughout the rest of the pages of the Bible in other books with their story being told. So it'll mention a name. And if you can go back in the Old Testament and find the story of that person, and it tells their story. You find out about their hardships, their fortunes, their good choices, and yes, the Bible includes their bad choices. But the unique thing about this particular group of people, those 35 that I counted, there are probably more, but I count at least 35 by going through, reading through, and counting where it mentions. According to verse 13 and verse 39, this group is looking for the kingdom. And one of the mistakes I made when I was doing this is not writing down these next verses. It's supposed to be on a slide, so I'm going to read it to you. Hebrews 11, the chapter before, remember. Hebrews is way at the end of the Bible, and if you're looking for the book. Hebrews 11, 13 says, "All these died in faith without receiving the promises." It sounds like a letdown, right? They all had promises, they all died, but they didn't get their promise given to them. Thanks, Timothy. I'll tell you when the next one goes on so you're not distracted. But they have welcomed them and seen them from a distance, having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. So that whole list of people didn't really feel like they belonged to this world. I'm doing the quotes. This world that we live in, they didn't feel like they belonged. They were looking for something different. They weren't finding what they were either promised or looking forward to in this world. And when they died, they still didn't receive it. And in verse 39, it says, and all these having gained approval through their faith, so this verse says that all those people are good people and will receive their promise, they have approval to get their promise, did not receive the promises. Even though they have approval, they didn't receive them. And then verse 40 includes us with them by saying, because God has provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. So verse 40 is talking about resurrection, where all those people that have accumulated through those years all the way from back here are resurrected at the same time when Jesus returns, that we would be made perfect at the same time they are. So they're all waiting for the same moment. So that's that list of people that's in Hebrews 11. That's what they were looking for. And that's talk about a resurrection, even though it doesn't say resurrection in there. You can read from the rest of the stories and put it in there. So the cloud of witnesses is that group of people, like a cloud, that we can go back and look at their stories to help us learn what to do. So that's what it said in Hebrews 12. We're surrounded by this cloud of witnesses, a great cloud. And the advantage of that is that we can go back and help us learn what to do. So we can learn from their stories and save us from a lot of danger and give us knowledge about how God deals with disobedience. Remember, the topic is about disobedience. So I want to use Jeremiah's experience. I said disobedience just a second ago, and this is page 5. It's the first time I said disobedience. I was trying to be positive. It was obedience, 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 then disobedience. I had to put a negative one in there. But I want to use Jeremiah's experience to help teach us. Not that Jeremiah, a different one. But he smiled when I said Jeremiah. So this slide is going to be up there a little while, so you can look at it while I'm talking, because you can see in the picture as I'm talking what I mean. I think that Jeremiah is in Hebrews 11, but not by name. In verse 36, it says, and it doesn't say Jeremiah's name anywhere in Hebrews 11, but I know that he's one of those that are looking for that promise. It says, and others experienced mockings and scourgings, and yes, also chains and imprisonment. Did you ever hear of Jeremiah before? If I click this, will it come up? Okay, can you even see that? Maybe if you took the next row of lights off, it would help. So I want to point out a little bit before I even begin. That's Nebuchadnezzar right there. You didn't know he looked like that, did you? Excuse me. So this is does this thing like go out real quick or something? Yeah, it does. That's Israel, and this is Judah. Two different nations. You can see they just drop off. You'll see that in the story. And you'll also see that these just drop off, and you'll see that in the story. And these numbers, number 6, number 7, number 8, are 100 years BC. So this is 600 BC, 700 BC, 800 BC. There's a lot of stuff on there, I get, but that's what I want you to notice. And this right here is Jeremiah, and he's weeping. He's called the weeping prophet, weeping Jeremiah in this story he is. So Jeremiah was included in Hebrews 11 by one of those that are imprisoned. And included in the 52 chapters of Jeremiah are several occasions where Jeremiah is beaten, imprisoned, and continually threatened to be killed. They were always trying to kill him. Several of those include standoffs in the temple to settle the bad news he continued to deliver to Judah. You can see Judah is still alive. See, here's Jeremiah. Israel already fell to the Assyrians. Over here, you're going to see that they will, But in his life, they were still hanging on. So they were trying to continually kill him. They beat him. They locked him up more than one time. God also commanded Jeremiah to not marry anyone. For more than 40 years, he proclaimed God's word of doom to Judah because of their disobedience. After King Solomon, those two lines used to be together. That's Israel, 10 tribes. This is Judah, 2 tribes. They used to be 12 tribes, all in one nation called Israel. But after King Solomon, the 12 tribes divided into 2 groups, 10 tribes, 2 tribes. You see them up there. The lower one is 2, the upper one is 10 tribes. 300 years before Jeremiah was born is when they divided. So it's not even on here. It'd be back here somewhere. It's where the kingdoms divided, 300 years before Jeremiah was even born. 100 years before Jeremiah was born is when the 10 tribes fell. You can see that right there. That's 100 years from Jeremiah to here. See, you've got your 6, you've got your 7. It's 100 years B.C. before Jeremiah was born, Israel fell. So he never even saw Israel. He only heard of Israel and had writings about what it was like and who they were and what they did or didn't do. So Judah was acting just like Israel did. The two tribes were acting just like, was acting just like the previous 10 that had already fallen. That's why God sent Jeremiah, to try to get them to recognize that they were doing wrong and correct it and be saved. But they didn't. You'll find out. Here are God's biggest complaints against Judah. I'm going to read 19 different verses out of Jeremiah. They're out of order. They're not out of order. They're in order, but there's a lot of verses that I'm not reading in between. But I want to read 19. I'm going to start in chapter 2 and read a verse here and there. Verse 3 says, Israel was holy to the Lord. This is how initially things were. Israel was holy to the Lord, the first of his harvest, who ate of it became guilty. Evil came upon them, declares the Lord. So Israel was good and became bad. We know that. Verse 8 says, the priest did not say, where, does that remind you of a movie? And I did not say, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, the priest did not say, where is the Lord? And those who handle the law did not know me. The rulers who transgressed before me and the prophets prophesied by Baal and walked after the things that did not profit. So the priest stopped paying attention to who God really is and started using other gods. That's in verse 8. Verse 9 says, therefore I will yet contend with you, declares the Lord. So there's a warning. I'm going to contend with you guys. With your sons' sons I will contend. With you and your sons' sons I will contend with you. That's a warning. Verse 11 says, a nation changed gods when they were not gods, but my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. They took their focus from God, who led them through Exodus out of Egypt, and turned to gods that were made out of wood and stone. They didn't profit them anything. God's help did profit. He gave them food. He gave them all those things. Verse 13 says, for my people have committed 2 evils. They have forsaken me. That's one. The fountain of living waters. All things come through God, even the creation. To hew for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. So they exchanged God, who gave them water, literally, in the wilderness, for cisterns or pottery or clay that can't even hold water. So, but they didn't recognize what they were doing. Okay, that's fine. Verse 13. That is verse 13. Verse 20, 19 and 20 says that for your own wickedness will you correct, for your apostasies will reprove you. Know therefore and see that this is evil and bitter, And you forsake the God, you forsake the Lord your God, and you dread of me is not, and the dread of me is not in you, declares the Lord of hosts. For long ago I broke your yoke, I tore off your bonds, but you said, I will not serve. For on every hill, or every high hill, and under every green tree, you have lain down as a harlot. So that was a representation of their idolatry. They exchanged God for idols. And it continues on through the whole book of Jeremiah describing all those things. And in all the way up to chapter 7, I'm going to skip to. And there are seven verses in a row that I want to read. The word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, and this is how God treated Jeremiah. He spoke to him, and he was to write it down, and then he was to go tell everybody what he just said. And it always got him in trouble. The word of the Lord came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, stand at the gate of the Lord's house and proclaim there this word and say. And that's what he told him to do. Go stand at the gate and say this stuff. Hear the word of the Lord, all you of Judah who enter by these gates to worship the Lord. So that's kind of a weird thing. He's standing at the church. Even though they've exchanged God for idols, they're still all going to church. So he's standing at the church and delivering the message. So they were kind of going to church, but they weren't taking to heart what they were supposed to. Thus says the Lord of hosts, in verse 3, God of Israel, amend your ways and your deeds, and I will dwell in this place. So I'm still giving you a chance. Do not trust in deceptive words and say, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. For if you truly amend your ways and your deeds, and if you truly practice justice between a man and his neighbor, if you do not oppress the alien, the orphans, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place or walk after other gods to your own ruin, then I will let you dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever. So he gave them that chance and gave them that chance and gave them that chance, but they didn't do it. They ignored Jeremiah's word. They put him in prison. They didn't listen to what he had to say. These are snippets out of Jeremiah up to chapter 7. The tone is quite grim for the outlook of Judah. In fact, at the end of Jeremiah's life, Judah fell. On that chart, you see, Judah goes into Babylon, who took over Assyria, who took over Israel earlier, 300 years earlier, or 400 years. King Nebuchadnezzar is the one that took over Judah. Then all of God's people, or God's chosen people, were in captivity. Jeremiah, the weeping prophet. Isn't that weird now? God has chosen people. He pulls out of Egypt, and now they're all in captivity. But you find out why they're in captivity. It's because they didn't obey God's words. Israel had 20 kings. You can see that top line. Each nation, Israel, I say Israel, the 10 tribes, and Judah, the 2 tribes, the one down further, each of them had 10 or 20 kings. Israel, the upper one, notice it fell before Judah, had no kings that sought after God. Remember, you had Saul, David, Solomon, your first 3 main kings of the all Israel 12 tribes, and then it gets divided because of taxes, the 10 tribes, the 2 tribes. The 10 tribes had no kings that sought after God. You know that David did. You know that Solomon did. And Saul was a little, he did sometimes. I don't know about Saul. He's harder for me to understand. But David for sure, and Solomon for sure, but all 20 of Israel's kings, not one of them sought after God. It's no wonder they fell. Judah had 20 kings. The lower kingdom had 20 kings as well. 7 of those sought after God. That's quite a bit better. They did last longer, another 120, 30 years, 40 years. 2 good kings in a row happened twice. Other than that, it was bad king, good king, bad king, bad king, bad king, good king, good king, bad king. 2 times a good king followed a good king. Seven sought after God. The last one, his name was Josiah, was the last good king. Was he the one? Was he seven when he became king? Yeah, he didn't know any better yet. That's why he was a good king. He wasn't corrupted yet. He was seven when he became king. It took people around them to also help them make up their decisions. But it seems like the biggest mistake that Israel made was they let these verses lose importance. And it's my belief that modern religion that we're in right now, with its take of who God is, a multi-personed entity, twisting the characteristics of what the Bible says God is kind of like the same type of a pattern. The neglected verses that Israel neglected was about who God is. And we'll read those in a second here. How about this second? Oh, it's one of those that I didn't write down. So it's in Deuteronomy 6. Excuse me. I have that cough stuff too, Sherry, that you were talking about for the respiration. And so does Micah. So, oh, Deuteronomy, not Jeremiah. I was so confused, but only for a second. Deuteronomy 6, I believe, are the verses that are lost their importance in the view of most of who Israel was. And it's kind of like the beginning commands that God made to Israel. Deuteronomy 6, 1 through 15. And here's what it says. Now this is the commandment, the statutes and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you. And this is Moses talking to the people on their way out of Egypt. They're all in a big group out wandering around in the desert for 40 years. You're going to go to a land which you're going to possess so that you and your son and your grandson might fear the Lord your God to keep all his commandments and statutes, which I command you, all the days of your life, that your days may be prolonged. You can see that their days were cut short. They were not prolonged. It's because they didn't continue this, what's going on. Verse 3, it says, O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you and that you may multiply greatly, just as the Lord your God, your father, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God. The Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. So that's the real message that God is giving Israel. And then he kind of puts conditions with it in these next verses. You shall bind them as signs on your hand. Wait, first of all, it's verse 7. You shall teach them diligently to your sons and shall talk of them when you sit down in your house and when you walk in the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. So they always should be on your mind. You shall bind them as signs on your hand and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on your doorposts and on the house and on your gates. And it shall come about when the Lord your God brings you into the land and which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, and great, splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of all good things which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns which you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, you shall eat and be satisfied. I'm going to give all this stuff to you for free. You don't even have to work for it. You're just going to get it. That was God's promise to his people. You can eat and be satisfied. Then watch yourself that you do not forget the Lord and who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And you shall fear only the Lord your God, and you shall worship him and swear by his name, and you shall not follow other gods, any of the gods of the peoples who surround you. For the Lord your God in the midst of you is a jealous God. Otherwise, the anger of the Lord your God will be kindled against you, and he will wipe you off the face of the earth. That's what it says in Deuteronomy 6, 1 through 15. you're going to have all this stuff for free and I'm going to be your God, but you have to remember that I'm your God. Not what everybody else is saying is God. So I think this Deuteronomy 6 command is being tested by modern views of God, that multi-God, instead of the one true God. I think that's part of, it's a parallel that we maybe should take a look at. You may say, well, what I just read was in the Old Testament. Well, now we live in the New Testament, so that stuff's all old, long ago. We don't need that anymore. Well, the New Testament has the same kind of words. In Matthew 22, for our closing verse, we have verses. There are three or four verses here in Matthew 22. It's Jesus speaking. I'll just read you the verses. Verses 34 through 40. It says, and this is nothing new, because everybody was trying to trick Jesus into something so they could condemn him. But when the Pharisees heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, it's a different group of religious leaders, they gathered themselves together. One of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him. Teacher, what is the great commandment in the law? So this is your New Testament version of what we just read. And he said to them, Jesus said to them, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind. This is the greatest and foremost commandment. And that's one that we can't forget. I think the Israelites forgot that, and then they were destroyed. So obedience to God, yeah, it could be pretty important. Verse 38 says, this is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. Obedience to God is included, or obedience to God is including and holding these verses high in your Christian values. We can't forget right from the beginning who God is. And know who he is, not who people say he is. And I'll continue more about obedience in my next message to help answer some of those other questions that I didn't get an answer to. So let us close and stand by singing song number 341.